Let's get back to that business of me and I. There's that marvelous sentence in the Gospels, and, well, one finds it in most religious literature, and all religious and spiritual literature, mystical literature, about dying to the self, about denying oneself, about losing the self. Remember? All right. How does one lose oneself? Ever tried to lose something? That's right. The harder you try, the more difficult it gets if you really want to lose it. As she says very well, when you're not trying, then you lose things. You lose something when you're not aware. You drop it. Or how does one die to the self? We're talking about death now. We're not talking about suicide. We're not told to kill the self, but to die. And to deny the self. Does that mean one causes pain to the self? One causes suffering to the self? But that would be self-defeating. That would be counterproductive. You're never so full of yourself as when you're in pain. You're never so centered on yourself as when you're depressed. You're never so ready to forget yourself as when you're happy. Happiness releases you from the self. It's suffering and pain and misery and depression that ties you to the self. Look how full you are of your tooth when you have a toothache. When you have no toothache, you're not even aware you've got a tooth. Or that you've got a head, for that matter, when you have no headache. But it's so different when you have a splitting headache. So it's quite false, quite erroneous to think that the way to deny the self is to cause pain to the self, to go in for abnegation, mortification, as it was traditionally understood, and to cause suffering. To deny the self, to die to it, to lose it, is to understand its true nature. And it will disappear, it will vanish. I frequently give the example of somebody who walks into my room one day, and I say, come right in. May I know who you are? He says, I am Napoleon. And I say, precisely, Bonaparte, that's right. Emperor of France, what do you know? And I'm thinking to myself, I'd better handle this guy with care. Sit down, Your Majesty, says I. So he sits down. And I say, what can I do for you? And he says, well, they tell me you're a pretty good spiritual director, and I've come up with a spiritual problem. I'm anxious. I'm finding it hard to trust in God because I've got my armies in Russia, see? And I'm spending sleepless nights wondering how it's going to turn out. And I say, well, Your Majesty, I could certainly propose something for that. What I suggest is that you read Matthew 6. You know, look at the birds of the air, look at the lilies of the field. They're not anxious. They're not worried. By this stage, you're wondering, by the time we get to this stage, you're wondering, who is crazier, he or I? But I'm going along with this lunatic, see? That's what the wise guru does with you in the beginning. He goes along with you. He takes your troubles seriously. He'll wipe a tear or two from your eye. Because you're crazy, but you don't know it as yet. The time soon has to come when he'll pull the rug from under your feet and tell you, get off it, you're not Napoleon. In those famous dialogues of Catherine of Siena, God is reported to say to have said to her, I am he who is. You are she who is not. Ever experienced your is-notness? In the East, we have an image for this the image of the dancer and the dance. God is viewed as the dancer and creation as his dance. It isn't as if he is the big dancer and you are the little dancer. Oh, no. You got it all wrong. You're not a dancer at all. You are being danced. Ever experienced that? When this guy comes to his senses and realizes that he is not Napoleon, he does not cease to be, he continues to be. But he suddenly realizes that he is something other than what he thought he was. Is that clear? He realizes that he is something other than what he thought he was. To lose the self is to suddenly realize that you are something other than what you thought you were. You thought you were center. Now you experience yourself as satellite. You thought you were dancer. You now experience yourself as danced. Now these are analogies. These are images. You cannot take them literally. They just give you a clue. They give you a hint. They're pointers. Don't forget. So you cannot press them too much. Don't take them literally. I'll come back to this idea again when we come back to the scriptures. The scriptures are mystical poetry. They're not scientific descriptions. But more about that when we come to the Bible. So, the loss of the self. When you understand who, what, you are, the self, the illusory self, is lost. As a step to attaining that, to moving towards that, I suggest this. Again, this is a kind of an imagery. Now, don't go around imagining that this I is another guy and me is another person. No. These are ways of talking. But as you begin to understand the transitory nature, the transient nature of all these things that they keep attributing to you, you dissociate yourself increasingly from them. That's about the best you can do, I think, to prepare the ground for the loss of the self, for the death to the self. To move on to another idea, this whole matter of one's personal worth, self-esteem, self-worth, where do you get it from? Do you get it from success in your work? Do you get it from having a lot of money? Do you get it from attracting a lot of men if you're a woman, or a lot of women if you are a man? How fragile that is. How transitory. And when we talk about self-worth, are we not talking really about how we are reflected in the mirrors of other people's minds? Do we need to depend on that? One understands one's worth, again, a way of talking, when one no longer identifies or defines oneself in terms of these transient things. One no longer does that. I'm not beautiful because everyone says I'm beautiful. I'm really neither beautiful nor ugly. These are things that come and go. I could be suddenly transformed into a very ugly creature tomorrow. But I is still I. And then again after plastic surgery, I become beautiful. Does the I really become beautiful? See, you'll need to give a lot of time to reflect on these things. I've sort of thrown them at you in rapid succession. But if you would take time out to understand what I have been saying, to dwell on it, my, you have a gold mine there. I know, because when I stumbled upon these things, what a treasure I discovered. And to summarize some of that stuff I was giving you this morning, you know, I put it in a simple sentence. Pleasant experiences make life delightful. Painful experiences lead to growth. Pleasant experiences make life delightful. They don't lead to growth in themselves. What leads to growth is painful experiences. Suffering points up an area in you where you have not yet grown, where you need to grow and be transformed and changed. Just as physical pain points to an illness in your body. If you would know how to use that suffering, oh, how you would grow. Let's limit ourselves for the time being to psychological suffering, to all those negative emotions. Don't waste a single one of them. I told you this morning in that four-point program what you could do with these emotions. That disappointment you experience when events don't turn out as you wanted them to. Watch that. What does that say about you? But without condemnation, or you're going to get caught up in self-hate now, or self-dislike. Observe it as you would in another person. Look at that disappointment. That depression you experience when you are criticized. What does that say about you? How much you will learn. That anxiety you experience, that worry. Ever heard about the guy who says worry doesn't help? It certainly does. Every time I worry about something, it doesn't happen. So it certainly helps him. Or the other one who says the neurotic is a person who worries about something that did not happen in the past. Not like us normal people who worry about things that will not happen in the future. That's it. That worry, that anxiety, what does it say about you? What's happening to you? So, if you would use this negative feeling, every negative feeling, every psychological suffering for awareness, for understanding, for dissociating from the feeling, and watching it from outside. In the beginning, the depression will still be there, but you will have cut your connection with it. Gradually, you will understand the depression. As you understand it, it will keep coming less frequently and will disappear altogether. Maybe, but by that time it won't matter too much. Before enlightenment, I used to be depressed. After enlightenment, I continue to be depressed. Wakefulness, that's where you are likely to get, gradually, or rapidly, or suddenly. The state of wakefulness, which is the state where you drop desires, but remember what I said, I meant by desire. Craving, meaning, unless I get what I desire, I refuse to be happy. I've made my happiness depend on the fulfillment of this desire. Desire in this sense, to drop desire, to drop illusion. Not to suppress desire, because then you'd become lifeless. You'd be without energy. That would be terrible. Desire, in the healthy sense of the word, is energy. And the more energy we have, the better. That's marvelous. That's wonderful. So don't suppress that now. Understand it. Understand it. Don't seek to fulfill the desire so much as to understand the desire. And don't just renounce the objects of your desire. Understand them. See them in their true light. See them for what they are really worth. Because if you just suppress your desire and you attempt to renounce the object of your desire, you're likely to be tied to it. Whereas if you look at it and see it for what it is really worth, if you understand how you are preparing the ground for misery and disappointment and depression, your desire will then be transformed into what I called a preference. Remember? You've got a baby boy. Oh, I'm quite happy because that was my second choice. Remember? Now, when you go through life with plenty of preferences, but you don't let your happiness depend on any one of them, then you're awake. You're moving towards wakefulness. And then, dropping your illusions, happiness, call it what you wish, is the state of non-illusion, where you see things not as you are, but as they are, inasmuch as this is possible to the human being. To drop illusions, to see things, to see reality. Every time you are unhappy, you have added something to reality. It is that addition that makes you unhappy. I'll repeat that. You have added something. There is a negative reaction in you. Reality provides the stimulus. You provide the reaction. You have added something. And if you examine what you have added, there's always an illusion there. There's a demand, an expectation, a craving. Always. Examples of illusions, they abound. But as you begin to move ahead along this path, you will discover them for yourself. For instance, the illusion, the error of thinking, but that by changing the exterior world, you change. You do not change if you merely change your exterior world, if you get yourself a new job, or a new spouse, or a new home, or a new guru, or a new spirituality. That doesn't change you. It's like imagining that you change your handwriting by changing your pen, or that you change your capacity to think by changing your hat. That doesn't change you really. And most people spend all of their energy attempting to rearrange the exterior world to suit their tastes. And sometimes they succeed, you know, for about 5 minutes, and they get a little respite. And they are tense even during that respite, because life is always flowing. Life is always changing. And if you want to live, you must have no permanent abode. You must have nowhere to rest your head. You have to flow with it. As the great Confucius says, the one who would be constant in happiness must frequently change. Flow. But we're looking back, are we not, and clinging to things in the past, and clinging to things in the present. When you set your hand to the plow, you may not look back. You want to enjoy a melody, you want to enjoy a symphony, don't hold on to a few bars of the music now. Don't hold on to a couple of notes. Let them pass. Let them flow. The whole enjoyment of a symphony lies in your readiness to allow the notes to pass. Whereas if a particular bar were to take your fancy and you would shout to the orchestra to keep playing it again and again and again, that wouldn't be a symphony anymore. Are you familiar with those tales of Nasruddin? There's one tale of Nasruddin, the old mullah. He's a kind of a legendary figure. The Greeks, the Turks, the Persians, they all claim him for themselves. So there he was. He would give his mystical teachings in the form of stories, generally funny stories. And the butt of the story was generally old Nasruddin himself. So Nasruddin was one day strumming a guitar, or he was playing one note. And after a while, a crowd collected around him. This was in the marketplace. And one of the men there in the crowd said, "That's a nice note you're playing, Mullah. But why don't you vary it a bit like the other musicians?" Nasruddin says, "Those fools, they're searching for the right note. I've found it." When you cling, life gets destroyed. When you hold on to anything, you cease to live. It's all over the gospel pages. And one attains this, my dears, by understanding. Understand. Understand another illusion, that happiness is not the same as excitement. It's not the same as thrills. That's another illusion. A thrill comes from the fulfillment of a desire, of a craving. It breeds anxiety, and sooner or later it brings its hangover. When you have suffered sufficiently from this, then you're ready to see it. You're feeding yourself on thrills. This is like feeding a racehorse with delicacies. You're giving it cake and wine. You don't feed a racehorse on that. This is like feeding a human being on drugs. You don't fill your stomach on drugs. You need good, solid, nutritious food and drink. Now you need to understand this for yourself, and there is another illusion that someone else can do this for you. That some savior or guru or teacher can do this for you. Not the greatest guru in the world can take one step for you. You've got to take it yourself. Saint Augustine says so marvelously, Jesus Christ himself could do nothing for many of his hearers. Or as I said to you the other day, that lovely Arab saying, the nature of the rain is the same, and yet it produces thorns in the marsh and flowers in the garden. It is you who have to do it. No one else can help you. It is you who have to digest your food. It is you who have to understand. No one else can understand for you. It is you who has to see. Nobody can see for you. And if what you seek is truth, then you must do this. You can lean on no one. Or another illusion, the illusion that it is important to be respectable. It is important to be loved and to be appreciated. It is important to be important. That we have a natural urge to be loved and to be appreciated and to belong. That's false. Drop your illusion and you will find happiness. We have the natural urge is to be free. The natural urge is to love, as I shall explain later. But not to be loved. You know, sometimes I get a client in some of my psychotherapy sessions, and one very common problem is, nobody loves me. How could I be happy? And I explain to him or her, you mean you never have any moment where you forget the fact that you're not loved and you let go and you're happy? Of course she has. She goes to a movie and she's all absorbed in the movie and it's a comedy and she's roaring with laughter. And in that blessed moment, she's forgotten to remind herself Nobody loves me, nobody loves me, nobody loves me, nobody loves me. And she's happy. Then she comes out of that theater with her friend, and her friend goes off with her boyfriend, her own boyfriend, and this girl's all alone, and she thinks, all my friends have their boyfriends. I've got no one. I'm so unhappy. Nobody loves me. This is like in India. Lots of our poorer people are beginning to acquire transistors, which is quite a luxury. Everybody got a transistor. I don't have a transistor. I'm so unhappy. But until everybody acquired a transistor, you were perfectly happy without one. Until somebody told you that you wouldn't be happy unless you were loved, you were perfectly happy. You become happy not by being loved, my dears, which means by being desired, by being attractive to someone. That's what you mean by being loved. You become happy by contact with reality. That's what brings happiness. By a moment-to-moment contact with reality. That's where you find God. That's where you find happiness. But most people are not even ready to hear that. All right, what can one do? Another illusion, the belief that reality, external events have the power to hurt you. That other people have the power to hurt you. They don't. It is you who give it to them. Another illusion, you are all those labels that people have put onto you or that you have put onto yourself. You're not. You're not. So you don't have to cling to them. You know, the day somebody tells me I'm a genius and I take that seriously, I'm in big trouble. Can you understand why? Because I'm going to be tense now. I got to live up to it. I got to maintain it. I got to keep it. I got to find out after every lecture, did you like the lecture? You still think I'm a genius? See? So what you need to do is smash it. Smash it and you're free. Don't identify with those labels. That's what he thinks. That's how he experienced you at that minute. Are you a genius? Are you a nut? Are you a mystic? Are you crazy? Does it really matter? Provided you continued to be aware and you continued to live life from moment to moment. How marvelously described in those words. You want to know who the mystic is? You want to know who the awakened person is? Look at the birds of the air. Look at the lilies of the field. They do not toil. They do not spin. They do not gather up into barns. So why are you anxious? Can you, for all your anxiety, add a single moment to your life? Why bother about tomorrow? Is there a life after death? Will I survive death? Why bother about tomorrow? Get in to today. Someone said, life is something that happens to us while we're busy making other plans. That's pathetic. Live in the present moment. Now, this is one of the things that you will notice will happen to you as you're coming awake. You are living in the present. You are tasting every moment as you live it. Another fairly good sign. You're hearing the symphony, one note after the other. That brings me to what I said I would talk to you about. You could call it another theme, another topic. But it ties in very much with what I've been saying this morning and right now. Awareness. The things we add to reality. Let's take that one step at a time. Are you tired? Is it all right for me to go on to this next topic? I'll go on for a little while, then give you a break. You stand up and chat, etc. Now, Father Fitzpatrick, who's here, told me the other day how he gave a talk here in New York. When there was this years ago, he got himself into Time magazine because he gave a talk when the Puerto Ricans were very unpopular because of some incidents that had happened here. Everybody was saying all kinds of things against the Puerto Ricans, etc. And he sort of gave a lecture somewhere here in New York where he said, well, let me read to you some of the things that the people of New York were saying about certain immigrants. And he was reading things that people were really saying about the Irish and about the Germans and about every new wave of immigrants that came in. I remember he put it very well that day at dinner. He said, these people don't bring delinquency with them. They become delinquents when they're here, when they're faced with certain situations. We've got to understand that. If you want to cure the situation, it's useless reacting from prejudice. You need understanding. You don't need condemnation. Not by saying, you dirty old sinner. No, 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 no. What's going on? Understand. Awareness. But in order to get awareness, you've got to see. And you cannot see if you're prejudiced. Now, I got news for you. Almost everything and person that we're looking at in a prejudiced way. It's almost enough to dishearten anybody. Take my friend. I meet him after a couple of years. And I say, hey, Tom, it's good to see you. And I give him a big hug. Whom am I hugging? The guy here or my memory of him? A living human being or a corpse? I'm just assuming that he's still the attractive guy that I thought he was. I'm just assuming that he still fits in with the idea I have of him, with my memories and associations, etc. And so I give him a hug. 5 minutes later, I find he has changed. I got no interest in him. Hug the wrong person. You want to see how true this is? Listen. I get this from religious communities in India. Sister goes to make a course, or she goes for a retreat. Everybody in the community is saying, oh, we know. You know, that's part of her charism. She's always attending workshops and going to retreats. Nothing will ever change her. Now, it so happens that Sister does change at this particular workshop or therapy group or whatever it is. She changes. Everyone notices the difference. Everyone says, my, you've really come to some insights, haven't you? And she says, yes, and she has. And they can see the difference in her behavior. You can see it in her body. You can see it in her face. You always do. When there's an inner change, it always registers in your face, in your eyes, in your body. Well, now, Sister goes back to the community. And since the community has got a prejudiced, meaning fixed idea about her, they're going to look at her through the eyes of prejudice. They've got a picture of her stuck on their window, and they're looking at her through that picture. And they're the only ones who don't see any change. You know what they say? Oh, well, you know, she seems a little more hidey-flighty and a little more cheerful, but just hang around, she'll be depressed again. And you know something? Within a couple of weeks, she's depressed again. She's reacting to their reaction. And they all say, see, we told you so, she hadn't changed. But the tragedy is that she had, only they didn't see it. What is a relationship? Ready for a bombshell? Hold on to your seats. Whatever a relationship may be, it certainly entails two things. Clarity of perception, in as much as we are capable of it. Some people would dispute to what extent we can attain this clarity of perception. But I don't think anyone would dispute that it is desirable that we move towards it. Clarity of perception. Accuracy of response. You're more likely to respond accurately when you perceive clearly. When your perception is distorted, you're not likely to respond accurately. Tell me, how can you love someone whom you do not even see? Let's make it worse. Do you really see someone you're attached to? Do you really see someone you're afraid of and therefore dislike? Because we always hate what we fear. Remember I told you, you have to be very careful with sentences of scripture, because if you're sleeping, you'd very easily misunderstand it. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. People say to me sometimes, hey, wait a minute, I hope you're understanding what you're saying. Because we always hate what we fear. We always want to destroy and get rid of and avoid what we fear. When you fear somebody, you dislike that person inasmuch as you fear the person. And you don't see that person. Your emotion gets in the way. But that's just as true when you are attracted to someone. When love enters, you're going to find this hard to believe, you no longer like and dislike people in the ordinary sense of the word. You see them clearly and you respond accurately. Oh, at this level, this will go on, your likes and dislikes and preferences and attractions, etc., etc. You'd be fully human in the mechanical sense of the word and fully divine, because this won't come in the way of love when you're aware of it. You'll be aware of your prejudices, your likes, your dislikes, your attractions. They're all there. They come from your conditioning. Because tell me, what is it that you like? How come you like things that I don't like? Because your culture is different from mine. Your upbringing is different from mine. If I gave you some of the things to eat that I relish, you'd turn away in disgust. We've got people up there in certain parts of India who enjoy dog flesh. And I know people who, if they were told they were being served dog steak, would vomit. Why? Different conditioning. Different programming. I could bring Hindus here who would vomit if they knew they had eaten beef. But you enjoy it. They said, but why won't they eat beef? For the same reason that you don't eat your pet dog. The same reason, no other. Because the cow to the Indian peasant is what your pet dog is to you. That's what it is. He doesn't want to eat it. They've got a whole cultural built-in prejudice against it, which saves the animal that's needed for farming, etc. So, when you have, see, why do I fall in love with you really? Why is it that I fall in love with one type of person and not another? Because I've got a shopping list, see, inside. I'm conditioned. I've got a kind of an image subconsciously. This particular type of person appeals to me, attracts me. So when I meet this person, I fall head over heels in love. But have I seen her? No. I'll see her after I have married her. That's when the awakening comes. And that's when love may begin. But falling in love has nothing to do with love at all. That isn't love. That's desire. That's burning desire. You want, with all your heart, to be told by this adorable creature that you're attractive to her. That gives you a tremendous sensation. And everybody else is saying, what the hell does he see in her? That's his conditioning. He's not seeing. They say, don't they, that love is blind. Believe me, there's nothing so clear-sighted as love. Nothing. The most clear-sighted thing in the world. Addiction is blind. Attachments are blind. Clinging and craving and desire is blind, but not love. Don't call that love. But of course, the word has been desecrated in most modern languages. People talk about making love and falling in love. Like the little boy who says to the little girl, have you fallen in love? Have you ever fallen in love? She says, no, but I have fallen in like. So what are people talking about when they fall in love? Now, the first thing, therefore, that we need is clarity of perception. Why do we not perceive people clearly? First, the first reason is evident. Our emotions get in the way. Our conditioning, our likes and our dislikes. We've got to grapple with that. But we've got to grapple with something much more fundamental. With our ideas. With our conclusions. With our concepts. Believe it or not, every concept which was meant to be a help to get in touch with reality ends up by being a barrier to getting in touch with reality. Because sooner or later we forget that the word is not the thing. The concept is not the thing. They're different. That's why I said to you the other day, the final barrier to finding God is the word God and the concept God. Comes in the way, if you're not careful. Was meant to be a help, can be a help, but can also be a barrier. Unless you realize very clearly that the word is not the thing. Metaphysics, or whatever you want to call it, but it's very, very simple. Listen to this. Every time I have a concept, it is something that I could apply to a number of individuals. We're not talking about a concrete particular name like Mary or John, which doesn't have a meaning. But when I have a concept, all other words are words that apply to any number of individuals, countless individuals, concepts. Are universal. For instance, I say tree, or I say leaf. Now the word leaf could be applied to every single leaf on that tree. You have the same word for all those individuals. You have the same word for all the leaves on all the trees in this campus. The big ones, the small ones, the tender ones, the dried ones. The yellow ones, the green ones, banana leaves, oak tree leaves, all types of leaves. If I say to you, I saw a leaf this morning, you really don't have an idea of what I saw. Let's see if you can understand that. You do have an idea of what I did not see. I did not see an animal, I did not see a dog, I did not see a human being, I did not see a shoe. You have some kind of a vague idea of what I saw, but it isn't particularized, it isn't concrete. The Spanish philosopher Unamuno says, man, human being, but let's stick to man, not primitive man, not civilized man, not a grown-up man, not a child, not male, not female, not of this particular age or the other, not of this culture or the other. In other words, not man. Because the human being is found concrete. You never find a universal human being like your concept. Your concept points. But it is never entirely accurate. It misses uniqueness. It misses concreteness. For the concept is universal. And when I give you a concept, I give you something. And yet, how little it is I have given you. So, the concept, so valuable, so useful for science. For instance, if I said of every one of us here that we are animals, that would be perfectly accurate. But you know, we're something more than animals. And so if I said, Mary Jane is an animal, that's true. But since I've omitted something essential to her, it's false. It does her an injustice. And when I call you a woman, that's true. But there are lots of things in you that don't fit into that concept. You are this particular, concrete, unique woman. That can only be experienced. It cannot be conceptualized. That I've got to see for myself. I've got to experience for myself. I've got to intuit for myself. The individual can be intuited, cannot be conceptualized. It's beyond the thinking mind. Lots of you would probably be proud to be called Americans, as lots of Indians, foolishly I think, would be proud to be called Indians. Because what is American? What is Indian? It's a convention. It's not part of your nature. But never mind about that now. And yet, even if you were proud to be called an American, if someone said to me, in reply to my question, who's Claire? And he says, Claire, she's an American. Oh, American. Ah, well, I know. Hey, she was quite proud to be an American. But when I said American, I know she feels insulted. Say, wait a minute, you really don't know. All you got is a label. You don't know me. See what I mean? The concept always misses, omits something extremely important, something precious that is found in reality, which is concreteness, uniqueness. Very important to understand that, as you recall, that the word, the concept, is not the thing. And so, the great Krishnamurti puts it so well when he says, the day you teach the child the name of a bird, the child will never see that bird again. How true. The first time the child sees that fluffy, alive, moving object, and you say to the kid, sparrow, sparrow. Then tomorrow, when he sees another fluffy, moving object that's similar to this one, he says, oh, sparrow, I've seen sparrows. I'm bored by sparrows. You know something? If you didn't look at things through your concepts, you'd never be bored. Every single thing is so unique. Every sparrow is so unlike every other sparrow. Even in its similarity, great help to find similarities so that we can abstract, so that we can have a concept. Great help from the point of view of communication, indication, science. But also very misleading and a great hindrance to seeing this concrete individual. And what about this particular sparrow? It keeps changing, you know, from moment to moment. But we're coming to that immediately. The first drawback in a concept is that the concept is abstract, reality is concrete. I don't think anyone would quarrel with that. So if all that you experience is your concept, you're not experiencing reality, because reality is concrete. The concept is a help to lead you to reality. But when you come there, then you've got to intuit or experience it directly. Second quality of the concept. It is static. Reality is in flow. We know enough to realize this. We have the same name for the Niagara Falls. But that whole body of water is constantly changing. How could you ever invent different words for each little movement of the river? You've got a word river, but that water is constantly flowing. The word remains static. You've got one word for your body, but all the cells in your body are constantly being renewed. That's another drawback in the concept when it is compared to reality. And to give you an idea of what it is like, let's suppose there's an enormous wind outside here, and I want the people in my country to get an idea of what an American gale or hurricane is like. So I capture it in a cigar box, and I go back home and say, "Behold, well, it isn't a gale any longer, is it, once it's captured?" Or I want you to get the feel of what the flow of water in a river is like, and I bring it to you in a bucket. Well, the moment I put it into a bucket, it stopped flowing. The moment you put it into a concept, it stopped flowing. It became static. It became dead. Something like a frozen wave. A frozen wave is not a wave. A wave is essentially movement. It is action. And when you freeze it, it's not a wave. Concepts are always frozen. Reality flows. Finally, if we are to believe the mystics, and it doesn't take too much of an effort to understand this, or even believe it, one can see it at once. Reality is whole. Words and concepts fragment reality. They give us little fragments. That is why it is so difficult to translate from one language to another, because each language cuts reality up differently. The English word home is impossible to translate into French or Spanish. Casa is not quite home. It has associations which are peculiar to the English language. Every language has untranslatable words and verbs and expressions. Because we're cutting reality up and adding something or subtracting something, and usage keeps changing. Reality is a whole. Then we cut it up and make concepts and words to indicate different parts. But if you had never seen an animal in your life, and one day you found a tail, just a tail. You've never seen an animal in your life. And somebody said to you, "That's a tail." Would you have any idea of what that was? Unless you had some idea of what an animal is. And unless you had some, couldn't be an idea, because ideas essentially fragment. Some vision, intuition, experience of reality as a whole? Would you really know what each fragment means? This is what the mystics are perpetually telling us. Words cannot give you reality. They only point. They only indicate. You use them as pointers to get to reality. But once you get there, you cannot, your concepts are helpless. Like the dispute that a Hindu priest had with a philosopher who claimed that the final barrier to God was the word God, the concept God. So he went to debate with him. And the philosopher replied, "The ass that you mount and that you use to get to a house is not the means by which you enter the house. You've got to dismount. You use the concept to get there. Then you dismount. You get beyond it. Now, you don't need to be a mystic to understand this, that reality is something that cannot be captured by words or concepts. If you would understand, if you would know what reality is, you would have to know beyond knowing. Do those words ring a bell? Those of you who are familiar with the cloud, you've got to go beyond knowing. You've got to know beyond concepts, beyond words. Poets, painters, mystics, the great philosophers, they have intimations of this, intuitions of this. Now comes the big part. Let's suppose that one day I'm watching a tree. Until now, every time I saw a tree, I said, well, you know, tree. But today when I'm looking at the tree, I don't see a tree. At least, I don't see what I've been accustomed to seeing. Suddenly I see something with the freshness of the vision of the child. There's no word for it. I see something that's unique, that's flowing, that's whole and not fragmented. And I'm in wonder. Now when I come back and you say, what did you see? What do you think I'd say? No word for it. There is no word for reality. Because as soon as I put a word to it, we're back into concepts again. I could tell you a story. And if you have the sense of a mystic, you might get a clue to what I'm talking about. But I cannot give you a description. My dears, if I cannot express this reality that I experience or intuit when I look at a tree, when you talk about expressing God, what are you talking about? If I cannot express this reality that is visible to my senses, when I penetrate, I get beyond words and concepts and see, how does one express what cannot be seen by the eye or the ear? How does one find a word for it? Are you beginning to understand what Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, and all of them were saying? What the church teaches constantly when she says, God is mystery, unintelligible to the human mind. What the great Karl Rahner said in one of his last letters, when he wrote to a young German drug addict who wrote to him for advice and talked to him about God. He says, you, theologian, you talk about God. How could this God be relevant in my life? How could I get rid of my drug? And Rana says to him, I must confess to you, in all honesty, that for me, God is and has always been absolute mystery. I do not understand what God is. No one can. We have intimations, inklings, that we falteringly, inadequately attempt to put into words. But there is no word for it. There is no sentence for it. I'm talking to a group of theologians in London, I think it was, he said to them, the task of the theologian is to explain everything through God and to explain God as unexplainable. Unexplainable. Mystery. One doesn't know. One cannot say. One says, And when one reveals God, one is using words, is not one. One is using concepts. And once again, all the great mystics in the Catholic Church, in all the Christian churches, in all the religions are telling us those words are pointers. They're not descriptions. They don't fit. They indicate. They give you a clue. Now, tragically, people fall into idolatry because they think that where God is concerned, the word is the thing. Now, how could you get so crazy? Can you be crazier than that? That where human beings are concerned and trees and leaves and plants and animals, the word is not the thing. But where God is concerned, the word is the thing. What are you talking about? That's why I told you last night about that famous internationally known scripture scholar who attended this course of mine in San Francisco a couple of years ago and said to me, "My God, after listening to you, I understand that I've been an idol worshipper all my life." And as I said to you last night, he said this right out in the open there. Big man. It never struck me that I had been an idol worshipper. My idol was not made of wood or of metal. It was a mental idol. And these are the more dangerous idol worshippers. Very subtle substance that is used to produce this God, who has no name, no form, no image. There are only indications. There are clues. More about this when I talk about the scriptures. What I'm leading you to this afternoon is the following. Awareness of reality around you. Do you remember I said, what is awareness? It means to watch, to observe what is going on within you, and around you, going on, pretty accurate, because things are going on. The trees, the grass, the plants, the animals, the rocks, all of reality is moving. One observes it. One watches it. How essential it is for the human being to observe not just himself or herself, but all of reality. You are imprisoned by your concepts. If you want to break out of the prison, look, observe. Spend hours observing, watching. What? Anything. The faces of people. The shape and form of trees, a bird in flight, a pile of stones. Watch the grass grow. Get in touch with things. Look at them. Hopefully, you will break out of this habit, these rigid patterns that we have all developed, that our thoughts and our words have imposed on us. Hopefully, we will see. What will we see? This thing that we choose to call reality. Whatever is beyond these words and concepts. That is a spiritual exercise connected with spirituality, connected with breaking out of your cage, out of the imprisonment of your concepts and words. How sad if you would have passed through life and never seen it again with the eyes of a child. Don't lose your concepts, they're very precious. As a matter of fact, we begin without them. Then we develop concepts, because concepts have a very positive function. Thanks to them, it would seem, we develop this thing called intelligence. We're even able to then understand the limitations of concepts. Anyone who never learnt a language, who was never programmed, was never given words and concepts, would, it would seem, have no intelligence at all. And so we're invited not to become children, but to become like little children. We have to fall from the stage of innocence. We have to be thrown out of paradise and develop this I, this me, thanks to these concepts. And then we need to return to paradise again. We need to be redeemed again. We need to put off the old man, the old nature, the conditioned self, and return to the state of the child. But without being children anymore. So we start off looking at reality in wonder. But it isn't the intelligent wonder of the mystic. It's the formless wonder of the child. Then the wonder dies and is replaced by boredom as we develop language and words and concepts. Then hopefully, if we're lucky, we return to the wonder again.